Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Normally, we begin the show every single day we have, actually, since March, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. But I'm going to actually ask you for one day off. And the reason is that we Zoom on Sunday afternoon, and today, Sunday, October 11th, is Coming Out Day. And for those of you who don't know what Coming Out Day is, let me just share the definition. It was founded 32 years ago in 1988. National Coming Out Day occurred to disrupt the oppressive silence and homophobia associated with being lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and/or queer. Coming out is a powerful display of personal agency, pride, and representation. Coming out happens repeatedly throughout one's lifetime with friends, family, and coworkers. Providing a supportive and affirming response to anyone coming out helps to reduce harm, change homophobic or transphobic ideologies, and interrupt negative stereotypes, cultivating an environment where equality is valued and everyone can feel proud of who they are and that they are vital to a healthy and respectful community. So I went and found that definition from a university out in Oregon. And so let me just tell you who's going to be sitting here hearing me do this pontification, because I want them to weigh in. We have Ron Abramson, who we haven't talked to in a long time. He is a fabulous immigration lawyer. He's from New Hampshire and incredibly well-respected. And we're going to be touching on a couple of immigration issues, I hope. But if nothing else, I know he's well-versed. Welcome back to the program, Ron.
Great to see you all, such as it is. Thanks.
We have from North Carolina State, Stephen Green. He's a professor of political science, and I want to welcome Stephen back to the program. Welcome.
Always great to be with you.
And let me welcome to the program our regular Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. You can also hear him on New Hampshire Public Radio as a regular, and he has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Hi, Arnie. Good to be with you.
So I was thinking about Coming Out Day. And it brought me back to the amazing decision in Massachusetts by Margaret Marshall. And that was the first time that a court embraced the idea of gay marriage. And it was incredibly provocative, incredibly controversial. And Margaret, I think, wrote the best definition of marriage I have ever heard. It was so powerful to me that when my stepson got married, I actually used her definition of marriage. And I wanted to share with you the definition she penned in the Goodrich decision. And as they said in the New York Times, that decision remains one of the most full-throated and eloquent testimonials to the personal and cultural significance of marriage. And here's what she wrote. Because it fulfills yearnings for security, safe haven, and connection that express our common humanity. Civil marriage is an esteemed institution, and the decision whether and whom to marry is among life's momentous acts of self-definition. Decisions about sexual intimacy and raising children are, the opinion said, among the most basic of every individual's liberty and due process rights. And extending these rights did not put the institution of marriage at risk, she wrote. Alarms about the imminent erosion of the natural order of marriage were sounded over the demise of anti-miscegenation laws, the expansion of the rights of married women, and the introduction of no-fault divorce. Marriage, however, has survived all of these transformations. And what you may not know, gentlemen, is that when asked why she wrote this and what was the motivation, she reminded us that she grew up in South Africa, where as a white university student, she became deeply involved in the growing anti-apartheid movement. And she said as she realized that this decision was coming before her, she basically said she'd heard this before. And it might have well have just said, a black cannot, a black should not. And she suddenly went, that was wrong. And if it was wrong in South Africa, what you are saying about gays and transgenders is also wrong here. And that was her motivation for writing this. And I just thought that that was just absolutely spectacular. And part of the reason, and I'm going to go to you, Ron, is that I'm thinking about who we are and how we've expanded the franchise and how we've expanded the definition of marriage and how we have really recognized what civil liberties mean. And as I think about Coming Out Day, I am looking at what's happened in Michigan, which is absolutely incredibly terrifying, but not surprising. And what Stephen Green doesn't know, and let me share with my audience, is that they just shut down the campus of UNC Asheville. Why? Because there were bomb threats. Why? Because there was a mural about Black Lives Matter, and they wanted them to paint it over. And of course, what we know about places like North Carolina and Virginia and South Carolina is that there are a lot of removals of Confederate statues, removals of Confederate flags, and they are horrified that we should remove these things. And part of their response is, let's cover up Black Lives Matter. So I don't know what I'm asking, Ron, but I think this is a pivotal moment, not only about this election that's taking place, but how we define who we are.
I'm not sure what you're asking either, which should make it a lot easier to answer the question.
Exactly.
I think the problem we're facing, or a problem we're facing right now, is that not only are we in the midst of a pandemic, not only are we in the midst of unprecedented instability and chaos in a civic sense, but it feels like so much of the progress we've made over the last X number of decades is hanging by a thread and is very tenuous at the moment. And even was it just last week, and honestly, my perception of time, I don't mean this to be funny, is completely warped. I can't tell what was a few days ago, what was a few months ago at this point. I have to think about the weather or some other external event to mark it. But didn't we just have Justices Thomas and Alito basically suggesting that they want to take another shot at Obergefell and potentially reverse that decision that created marriage equality on a national scale that, you know, goes back to Justice Marshall. I mean, she really set the foundation, and then, you know, we in New Hampshire, as a point of pride, can say that we were the first state to legislate it. We didn't need to be, you know, faced with a court decision to create marriage equality. It was, you know, one of the best things Governor Lynch accomplished in his tenure. But it is a very difficult time, because it's really hard to move forward when you're worried so much about getting knocked backwards. And that's how it feels day in, day out on multiple fronts.
So Stephen, everyone keeps pointing to Donald Trump, that Donald Trump, you know, it's his fault that he really is the architect of all the things we're seeing. The denial of science, what happened to the response with COVID, the denial of climate change, the grotesque, you know, gap between rich and poor by giving, you know, corporations this incredible tax cut they didn't even ask for, by giving the rich more money. And now at this point in time, knowing that people are on bread lines, knowing that people are losing their jobs, knowing that people are losing their insurance, wanting to repeal the ACA and not provide another stimulus. But let's be honest here, Stephen. It ain't just Donald Trump. You know, he might be the cherry on the sundae, but they were definitely scooping it up and putting the whipped cream on for over a decade or two. And we can't be shocked. What we have to ask is, how did we allow this to happen? And why weren't the Democrats, 8 years of Barack Obama, 8 years of Bill Clinton, why did this continue to happen? And it happened on Democrat and Republican watches.
That's a tough question to answer. How did we allow this to happen? The metaphor that just came to my mind is, you know, you were talking about Donald Trump, is the lighter fluid that goes on the gas, you know, on the charcoal grill, and that we had these simmering charcoal briquettes that I think were kind of easy to ignore, and for our, you know, generally responsible mainstream media to do, you know, the nice little both sides dance on everything and whatnot. And when things are concerning, you know, we want things to be normal, right? I think there's a tendency to normalize until it reaches really extreme proportions. And so it's taken, you know, Donald Trump just dumping half the bottle of lighter fluid on the grill to just see this conflagration for us to recognize to a degree. We were onto these things, but, you know, society-wide, to recognize how much kind of low simmering racism and honestly antipathy towards democracy have been there, that, you know, Donald Trump has absolutely accelerated and empowered and done all these things while, you know, it had been kind of going on in the background.
So Dean, I always tell this story about the White Mountain Militia. So the militia in Michigan is not a shock to me. Let me introduce you to the militias in New Hampshire. And when did I meet the White Mountain Militia? When I was doing talk radio in White River Junction, Vermont in 1988. And they actually used to follow me because I would raise questions about guns on my radio show. And they would literally harass and follow and intimidate, okay? But the difference now is when they were doing that to me, they didn't have an echo chamber in Concord. They didn't have an echo chamber in the White House. They didn't have someone who really sort of saw them as a support system. And I think that's what's so terrifying is we've known about the militia. Social media has made it even more possible for these militias to sort of find each other and to find some common ground, even when they're normally very competitive. But what we have on top of social media is we have a socially defective president who is their echo chamber. And I think that's something that we never quite anticipated. We thought we could always somehow hold them down. But how do you hold them down when Donald Trump holds them up?
Yeah, I think that's true. It's, you know, it's been around for decades. It's nothing new. There's a lot of research that goes back decades looking at the you know, the impact of white supremacy, the impact of militias. Social media has certainly changed the game. It's allowing these groups to strengthen themselves by finding like-minded individuals to join in. And as we were saying, you know, President Trump really has, he's given a kind of a legitimacy or a visibility or acted as an accelerant, if you will. He's not the cause of it, but he certainly has been very instrumental in using it in, you know, different measured doses to kind of keep his support together. And so, yeah, we've always talked about it as kind of being, it is being there, but kind of being tamped down. I mean, I remember back in 1996, right before the New Hampshire primary, Pat Buchanan, hey, it was either Buchanan's campaign manager, there was something with the Buchanan campaign, now my mind's a little rusty on the details, but involving militias that threatened to jeopardize his performance in the New Hampshire primary. So that was, you know, that was 25 years ago that we were talking about this. But it is different to see it kind of used tactically by a president rather than a president working to kind of tamp it down.
So Ron, I've been thinking a lot. I don't sleep anymore. I'm sure most of us don't sleep anymore. And I've been thinking about, you know, what kind of a cocktail we have created. And because of our definition of Second Amendment, which now has virtually no limitations. I mean, people are, if you landed on this planet suddenly and you came into like New Hampshire or Michigan and you saw people carry open carry, you know, in the state house, you know, with carried concealed with no requirement to be licensed, when you realize how many, the proliferation of guns in this country. And so you look at this tsunami of weaponry, and then you look at social media, which has sped everything up like a whirling dervish. And then you look at grotesque inequality. And then you look at what climate change has done to some people so that they, every time they think that they're about to like sort of repair, they get wiped out again, you know? And then you look at the pandemic, which is also exacerbating what is clearly the case of those who have access to really good healthcare and really good food and really good jobs and those that don't. And I'm just trying to figure out, why didn't we think that even just one or two of those should have been addressed 30 years ago? How could we think that just growing the wealth for the rich would ever bring about a level of stability for a nation?
Well, I'm not the political scientist in the group, so no. I will stay in my lane a little bit on this, but I think there's been a lot of complacency. There are a lot of valid critiques of the Democratic Party. The Republican Party has been sowing a lot of these seeds, or at least, you know, tolerating them without any real resistance as a group for, it feels like, generations at this point. You know, we were talking about the history, but as you know, I was strongly affiliated with Elizabeth Warren's presidential campaign, and she kept saying this: we are no longer in a time where our problems can be addressed by nibbling around the edges. That's what she kept saying. And you know, the positive developments in some of the latest demonstrations and protests and national discourse is the fact that we have finally embraced the terminology of needing systemic change. There are questions about individual actions and individual injustices, say in the context of police violence, but really the changes have to be systemic. The changes have to be cultural. These are not going to be, the same way we're not going to save the environment because I stopped using disposable straws. We're not going to save the economy, and we're not going to create greater equity. And really, at the end of the day, this country had always been about the presumed equality of opportunity. Right. It's not that we're all equal. It's that we would all have equal footing to start and make our way. And there is absolutely no question that that is less true now than it's been in a long, long time.
So as we head into this election, one of the first articles I sent out to the three of you was "A Petulant Donald Trump Squanders His Best Chance for a Breakthrough." So Stephen, I don't know whether it's the medication he's on. I mean, he was so unstable before. How could you tell the difference? But there is no question that he wants to send a $200 card to all the seniors for their drugs, as if he's going to buy them. And then he says no to a stimulus, and then yes to a stimulus, and then he wants to have a bigger stimulus than even the Democrats and the Republicans. I mean, he's all over the map. So the problem isn't Donald Trump right now, because I think Donald Trump will just sign whatever is put in front of him. The problem right now is Mitch McConnell. What the hell does Mitch McConnell want? Because I know he wants a legacy of the court, and he's going to get that. There's no question. But I am just trying to figure out, what kind of a life does he want after November? Because life after November looks pretty depressing to me, because it looks like chaos, no money, every city and town is bankrupt. I mean, it's just, I'm just trying to figure out, Mitch McConnell is an institutionalist.
No, he's a pretend institutionalist. He has been posing as an institutionalist.
Explain that to me. Yeah. You're very good.
Right. The truth is, what does Mitch McConnell want? I mean, Mitch McConnell wants lower taxes for rich people and no effort to reduce the suffering and immiseration of poor and working class people. I mean, we've got decades-long record that show this is what Mitch McConnell truly believes. You know, Mitch McConnell probably, he's savvy, probably believes that Joe Biden will be the next president, and he knows that the worst economic situation that Joe Biden comes in with, and the situation of the debt and everything, the easier it is for him to say, oh, you can't spend all this money to do that stuff. So I mean, Mitch McConnell, this is what he wants. And I mean, one of the things following this somewhat closely is Republicans really believe this. They really have deluded themselves that somehow tax cuts for rich people are always going to be the solution to things. And, they are, again, have decades of training themselves to the immense suffering of so many ordinary Americans who are out of jobs and struggling and would benefit so greatly from this relief that they seem to have no interest in passing.
So let me just say something, Dean. I don't think you're right, Stephen. And the reason I say this is, when you think about Donald Trump's language, not his actions, his language. His language is actually against those rich bastards that are taking your jobs and moving your jobs overseas and doing all this stuff. His language actually is not the language of the Republican Party that you're talking about. I mean, I know he does the tax cuts, but he doesn't focus on the tax cuts, Dean, of the tax cuts he gave to the rich and corporate America. He focuses on that Joe Biden. What did Mike Pence say? That Joe Biden said he's going to get rid of the tax cuts. And so Pence looked at all those middle-class people and said, he's after you, is what he said. I mean, it's there's kind of an irony here, because the language of the Republican Party, Republican ideology, and what Donald Trump actually ran on are not the same thing. So Dee, my point is that the people that have embraced Donald Trump have not embraced the Republican ideology. They've embraced whatever Donald Trump is throwing at the wall. And what he's throwing at the wall, I mean, if you look at the Republican ideology, they're not as xenophobic as he is. When you look at the Republican ideology, they don't, basically French kiss Putin. When you look at the Republican ideology, they're not trashing the wealthy, even though he's wealthy. I mean, it's kind of, he's an interesting character, because I'm not sure what he's telling them, but I know they're believing it.
Yeah, well, he's focused on keeping that group of constituents tied in, and he kind of He's never really been ideological in nature. Yes. He's certainly not ideologically consistent. You know, there's a heavy dose of populism, but he also is isolationist in a way that would have been anathema to Republicans several cycles ago. You remember Ron Paul was excoriated for being isolationist by other presidential candidates, you know, back when he ran for president. And his whole language, trade language, helping out regular people, and Biden's going to raise your taxes. Yeah, it really is kind of an interesting inversion of traditional Republican ideology. But I think at this point, most Republican politicians have kind of given up trying to think through all that. And they're just kind of trying to read the tea leaves in terms of how it affects, you know, whatever he does, whether it's good or bad for their reelection chances. And that's really become this sort of very kind of pragmatic calculus, rather than any kind of elevated debates involving conservatism and liberalism, et cetera. We've kind of gone past that. That doesn't really seem to be driving things anymore. The folks that want to have that debate are now all part of the anti-Trumper,
The Lincoln Project.
You know, the Lincoln Project, Republican voters against Trump, et cetera.
I recommend that everyone go. I think it's the Atlantic Monthly has a great article about it. So before we end this first half, Ron, Lindsey Graham made an interesting statement in his debate with Jamie Harrison, and that is that Black people can go anywhere in South Carolina if they're conservative. So I'm just trying to figure out, how do you know a conservative Black person from a liberal Black person from a homeless Black? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, do they wear an identifying mark? I mean, it's that statement to me was just beyond shocking, because you can tell it's been a long time since he's been home.
Well, yeah, I guess they all need to get those Blexit outfits that everyone was wearing at the White House yesterday.
Yes.
You know, the turquoise shirt and the red hat that some people compared to a classic gnome ensemble. But
a Smurf.
Yeah, something like that. I have tossed that statement around in my, you know, elitist Yankee brain for a while, and I don't really understand it, so I don't see the value. It seems like Lindsey Graham is extraordinarily desperate. We just saw that Jamie Harrison set a quarterly Senate fundraising record. I think that was just released last night or today. He raised $57 million, and the best spin the GOP seems to be able to put on that is that it's a lot of out-of-state money. Which, if you pay attention to anything, you realize we all have a very big stake in the composition of the Senate, and it's impacting all of us through the courts and otherwise. I mean, no real business is getting done right now because it's all bottlenecking. So I think Lindsey Graham is in deep trouble. I hope he cannot fearmonger his way and otherwise raise his profile through the Coney Barrett nomination confirmation hearings. But it's going to be interesting. I mean, right now he refuses to take a COVID test.
Yeah. And that's
a whole other issue.
Right. And the COVID test is now, Stephen, I just want to go back to you. The COVID test is now going to be an issue for the Amy Coney Barrett hearings, because everyone is saying, I don't want to show up for this hearing without people taking a test. And everyone's kind of looking at Lindsey, Stephen, like, and I think you should go first, Senator Graham. I mean, look at this confluence of issues that are happening, and it's happening because of this court appointment.
Well, I mean, let's be honest, though, they will find a way to get around the court if they have to turn it into a super spreader event. I mean,
well, it might not be so easy to get people to show up for the super spreader confirmation vote now that they know about what happened at the super spreader Rose Garden.
Now, I think Mitch McConnell would take a case of COVID for a Supreme Court justice.
Actually, I don't know. I mean, I don't know about that. I mean, he's already said that he disagrees with the president. He's already said, I haven't visited the White House, Dean, since sometime in August. I mean, he knows self-preservation more than anything, Stephen. I'm just telling you this. So before we end, is there anything that the Democrats can do in order to stop this? Or is their only answer the idea of potentially increasing the size of the court? We've seen the court shrink with the Garland decision because they made no decision. And for over a year, they didn't have a full complement of justices. And that seemed to work perfectly fine. And if you can shrink the bench, why can't you enlarge the bench, Dean?
You could in theory. There's obviously nothing in the Constitution that prohibits changing the size of the court. In fact, I don't think we got up to 9 members until after the Civil War, I believe. The original Supreme Court back at the founding had like 5 or 6 members, I think. So you certainly could increase it. I think it would be a mistake politically. I think it would generate a tremendous amount of negative response from Americans who now, for better or worse, have come to see the court as set at 9. I saw footage of Biden himself talking about court packing a number of years ago and saying it's a bonehead idea. He's going to have to contend with that. This whole thing about not answering the question of whether or not he'll pack the court, it just seems like something he's doing. This is kind of a progressive fantasy that this is going to be, you know, some way to kind of right whatever wrongs they believe Republicans have committed. You know, so, and I'm talking purely just kind of from a strategic perspective.
So let me just say, so Stephen, I agree with you, just so you note. I am for increasing the size of the court, okay? I'm with you. And the people that aren't are already there. They want Amy Coney Barrett. We got them. They want to run in place. They want to control the agenda. They want to pack the court the way they want to pack the court. So people are thinking that this is just, we shouldn't do it. It's the third rail. It'll get people upset. And I'm thinking, really? How much more upset can we get, Stephen? I'm just trying to figure this out.
Yeah, I don't know that we have third rails anymore in 2020, for one thing. I mean, and again, I think, you know, if this is done as a larger part of court reform, which they can absolutely do, and which we've talked about before, I think the messaging on it can be, you know, I don't want to say necessarily good. There's going to be a lot of resistance, but not disastrous. And more importantly, you do this in 2021. Nobody's voting on this in 2022. I mean, voters just have the shortest memories. You do what you need to do. And Republicans know this, right? Republicans, they do what they need to do. And especially if it's well before an election. And, you know, you find me the voters in November 2022 are like, well, I would have, but for that 13-member Supreme Court. And, you know, I think that it's important. It's where Republicans are breaking all the norms of the court. In some way, the only thing you can't just constantly be rolled over. And, you know, otherwise it just continues and continues. And you're actually subverting democracy. And I would argue expanding. And I like the term expanding rather than packing.
Yeah, me too.
It's a necessary corrective.
Exactly. So Ron, and the other thing is that not only do I want to see that it expands, I kind of like the idea of term limits. And I think that we need to talk about this. All right, I see from Ken that we have to go to a break. All right, this is Rethink the Week on The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We are talking with Ron Abramson, an attorney, immigration lawyer from New Hampshire. We're talking with Stephen Green from North Carolina State and Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University. We will be right back.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds. Poor people gonna rise up, get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, run, run. Finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Oh no, talking about a revolution. Oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a real
Welcome back to Part 2 of Rethink the Week with The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, Ron Abramson is an immigration attorney from New Hampshire. Stephen Green is a professor of political science at North Carolina State. And Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. So I want to go back to you, Ron. So I like the idea of term limits as well. So the idea of, and part of the reason is that we're going to start like, you know, putting people on the bench that are in utero. Because the younger they are, the longer they're going to be on the bench, because we figured they're going to live to about 80 or 85 or however long.
The GOP supports that. They're all
about it. I know. They absolutely totally do. That's why they want to protect the unborn, as they say, because they're looking at them as future Supreme Court justices. But I do think that the idea of term limits is something that we should embrace, not only in the court, but frankly, I think we should embrace for Congress as well. So I think we should do a let's make a deal here. But on the Supreme Court, Ron, not only does it make sense, but let's be honest, look at how quickly the world has changed. And to have people on the bench for 30 and 40 years means they are really, they left life and went into the cocoon of the court. And now the world is a very different place. And I think the bench needs to be refreshed, and not just refreshed when someone dies, but refreshed on a fairly regular basis.
I have mixed feelings. I've been practicing law since 1993, so 27 and a half years, or about half as long as Ken has been.
Hey, be nice.
It's hard to embrace such a fundamental change to an institution that's looked as it has for well over a century. On the other hand, the Supreme Court gets big enough, maybe I have a shot at an appointment, but I think it would need to be 200, 300,000 members in order for that possibility. But the term limit issue is interesting. And where we see it in practice is when the Supreme Court is called upon to decide criminal justice, Fourth Amendment, you know, search and seizure issues with technology.
Okay.
And you know, they obviously have some of the best and brightest young minds working as clerks, but it becomes pretty clear from oral argument and in some cases from the actual decisions that some of these judges just do not really understand and appreciate the role and the advancement of technology in our everyday lives. And I think that speaks to your point about it becoming sort of out of touch. If you recall when George H.W. Bush had that moment of shock at a grocery store scanner, and you know, it's a silly little political episode, but it is illustrative. And you know, the fact is, one of the biggest problems about Donald Trump is he's never had a regular person's life from birth. He's never had many of the experiences that we've had. I mean, the way he acted behind the wheel of that 18-wheeler is the way someone acts who's never really gotten to drive a car.
Right.
And it just, there needs to be some balance. And in Congress, people come with real experience. And in the Senate, sometimes a little less so, or you get elected young, and you're right. There's comfort, there's inertia, there's a lack of growth and real contact. And I think term limits would serve so many purposes, but at the end of the day, you know, the role of money in all this is something we're going to have to address, again, systemically. And there remain questions about who paid off Justice Kavanaugh's debts.
Yep.
And how he got to be, you know, get a clean financial slate upon his confirmation.
Well, so, look what's just coming out, Dean. The story of Donald Trump suddenly getting this infusion of cash in order to pay for his 2016 campaign because he was a billionaire and he was going to self-fund. And I mean, think about this. I mean, this thing about money is so insidious because, and one of the reasons why I kind of like term limits is that in some ways, at least you have to buy the next politician, you know, because you're not on the same ka-ching change, you know, yeah. where they have war chests that are so intimidating that nobody wants to do it. You've actually developed relationships over decades. You've turned those relationships into legislation that's got different corporations' names on it. And now they're going to have to develop a new relationship. And I think if nothing else, that's helpful.
Yeah, well, I'm still contemplating Ron's comment about Donald Trump driving a car. I hadn't really thought about that. I don't even know if he has a driver's license. He can drive a golf cart, but I don't know that he's actually ever driven a car. It reminds me of a story Bill Clinton told after being governor and then president for 8 years. He had almost forgotten how to make his own telephone calls because he was so used to having other people dial the phone for him. So it's interesting to contemplate Donald Trump actually driving himself around Manhattan. You know, there's a lot of new reporting out now just about the extent to which the connection between Trump's private finances, you know, a variety of different deals, some like, again, back to this issue that we continually have with him overvaluing his properties as a means of getting tax breaks and other kinds of write-offs. You know, the connection between his properties and companies that use those properties while he's president and then get contracts. There's some new reporting in the New York Times on that. It's pretty swampy. And, you know, every president says they're going to clean things up and they don't always quite get there. But this seems particularly egregious. And, you know, I think if he loses, Trump's going to have his hands full dealing with a lot of these legal matters. I think probably him and several members of his family. I think Eric Trump was already recently deposed for one particular deal.
Right. So Stephen, here's my problem. As horrific as it is that we're talking about all these sort of swampy things with Donald Trump, we kind of sort of think that most of politics is kind of swampy. You know, we look at big pharma writing checks to people that are the chairman of committees that deal with pharmaceutical issues. And then we watch big oil and we watch big coil. I mean, Donald Trump does everything to an extreme. And he you know, he tells us what he's doing. The other guys hide what they're doing. But unfortunately, we actually have ways of sort of tracking the dollars and connecting the dollars to sort of certain kinds of outcomes. And I think that's part of what we're experiencing now, is that there isn't the same kind of revulsion for Donald Trump's behavior, because we've kind of made that assumption for decades, Stephen.
It's so right. And my 14-year-old son was asking me today, we were driving somewhere and just seeing all the political road signs, and he recently learned, you know, that roughly 60% of Americans can be expected to vote in the next presidential election. And he's astonished, right? He just can't get over it that it's not, you know, 90% something. And we're just so used to this. And we're used to 40% in off year and 20% in a local. But it's horrible, right? It was useful for me to see how astonished he is. And he's like, why do people not vote? And right. It's like, because they think it doesn't matter. They think it's a bunch of corrupt politicians, a bunch of big money, a bunch of corporations that no matter what they do, okay, Nothing's going to change. And if you have been watching TV between 7 and 7:30 every night, or like during local news, like we have in my house during a major election, we're watching Jeopardy, but all you get is ads. And again, hey, First Amendment campaign, but about how horrible, literally how horrible everybody in politics is. And, you know, if you don't know and you don't understand, you can easily just throw up your hands and say, oh, Donald Trump is just your standard politician. He's no more corrupt than the rest of them. But right, like the truth is, like, I don't know what scale you want to use, but everybody else on a 1 to 10 scale, everybody else is a 5 and Donald Trump is a 51. So, you know, we just lose all context for how absolutely horrible he is. And like, you know, I spend too much time on Twitter, but it was just exasperating yesterday where we have yet the latest revelations about how Donald Trump is absolutely running a giant con, a giant grift on the American people, subverting democracy. He has talk about drain the swamp. He has turned the entire something the size of Alaska into a giant swamp. And we're talking all about, well, should Joe Biden answer the court packing question this way? You know, so it's mind-blowing and frustrating and exhausting. And also at the same time, you can see how people can just get totally turned off from the process. So I don't know if that was an answer at all, but that sure felt good to get off my chest.
Oh, no. It's great to receive it. Let me just tell you.
Can I just add to that? And that is, I don't want to say by any stretch of the imagination that those people are right to say that why vote, because they're all corrupt. I agree with Stephen. Donald Trump is a 51 on a scale of 1 to 10, where everybody's between 1 and 10. Joe Biden is not. And our democracy will actually continue to exist if Joe Biden is elected president. But I think that the people who are turned off by voting have their finger on something. And that something really is corporate domination of our economic and political system. And Democrats, as well as Republicans, have been financed and often vote in the pocket of big money, wealthy people, the 1%, Wall Street. And centrist Democrats like Biden, God bless him, he's going to be a lot better than Donald Trump, but he gets his money from Wall Street corporate interests. He adopts policies that are middle of the road and support big business. And people who are looking for a country that is based on real fairness and the people, populism without the craziness, but real ordinary Americans, low-income, middle-income, working people, even upper-middle-class people, are not doing well nowadays. How much can we really influence either Democrats going forward or Republicans? I mean, Biden, if he gets elected, is he really going to move left like Donald Trump is scaring everybody, or is he going to move back to the bankers?
So Ron, one of the things I keep thinking about is I was listening to someone from the airline industry talking about, you know, we have to bail them out. This situation has never existed before. We need an airline industry that's surviving. And people were talking about, if I'm going to lose my job, you know, I'm going to lose my income, I'm going to lose my health care, how do I feed my kids? I'm going to have to get retrained because you can't be out of a job in an airline industry for a certain amount of time. And they were going through all this stuff. I'm thinking, what could you say about the meatpacking industry? What could you say? I mean, it's like all these stories are identical. And if we're going to write a check for the airline industry that pocketed huge profits, didn't put it aside, paid it out to all their, you know, shareholders and their senior management, and I'm going to suddenly like get hysterical about this, the story of the airlines is the story of all of us. And I'm just trying to figure out, why can't the Democratic Party say, I am with you, airlines, but guess what? Let's go through the rest of the alphabet. Because the rest of the alphabet is experiencing the same damn thing.
Capitalism is always about making choices for who's going to win and who's going to lose. We are a deficit society. We are always borrowing money to throw at our problems, never more so than right now. The Republican tax cut should go down as one of the worst public policy decisions in American history, but they will never own it. And they still don't own it. And you see Mike Pence against Kamala Harris trying to use it as an asset when it put a pittance in regular people's pockets and, you know, put in billions and billions of dollars into people who already have billions and billions of dollars. One of the ironies of all this is Donald Trump keeps making his nemesis Jeff Bezos richer and richer. So, you know, that and Bloomberg and pretty much all the billionaires who can't stand him. But it's, I don't know what it's going to take. I just don't understand what it will take to remove the even sort of well-intentioned, but nonetheless elitist and out of touch leadership that commands the Democratic Party, which is still trying to do something better for people, but only seems to be able to go so far and tends to worry more about offending a moderate core than really driving legitimate systemic change. I mean, when's the last time we saw sweeping national legislation that made a positive difference for the most number of people in this country? The 60s?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, and the sad thing is I want to go to the ACA because that's, you know, something that did definitely expanded health insurance. When I look at what the ACA did, which was definitely incredibly valuable, let me tell you who's making out like an absolute bandit, Dean, as a result of this pandemic. It's the insurance industry. And I mean the health insurance industry. And big pharma is making out like bandits as people are losing their health insurance, not being able to afford COBRA, not being able to sort of afford. So in a way, I kind of look at the Democrats and I keep thinking, we know about the instability of this economy. We know people don't have one job over the course of a lifetime. They're going to have seven or eight jobs over the course of a lifetime. And that means every time you leave a job, you are vulnerable to losing your health insurance or going for a period without health insurance. And you would think that they would read the tea leaves and suddenly realize that they need to do something that's not incremental. They need to do something that is absolutely challenging and changing.
Yeah, well, for better or worse, I think the Biden campaign has decided that going with a more comprehensive reform, whether it's a public option, although Biden mentioned offering a public option in addition to private insurance, but to go full Medicare for all, that I think they believe in the short term, that that's not a winning strategy, for just given their calculus of where voters are. You know, most of the discussion has been around the courts and the Trump administration trying to get Obamacare declared unconstitutional. And if you saw in the vice presidential debate several days ago that when Pence was asked about, you know, what is this alternative that's going to protect coverage of pre-existing conditions that Trump keeps talking about but never produces, he didn't answer the question. He started talking about court packing. So I think that's the most immediate issue. But it is true, most people don't work for a company for 25 or 30 or 35 never. Years anymore. They move around a lot, and that requires a different type of portability of insurance. So I think it's a big concern, but I think the debate has been kind of swamped by the court case on Obamacare and the belief among Democrats who are setting the strategy now that the Medicare for all, at least in the short term, is not the way to go.
So, Stephen, I saw your comment about it. You said it's tough when you're up against such shameless liars. I agree with you. And I think what happened was a lost opportunity during the vice presidential debate. Now, having done a lot of debates over the course of my lifetime, whether I like it or not, one of the skill sets I have learned is that when you see a Mike Pence get asked a question about the ACA and then flip it to something completely different, what you do is not only do you notice that he didn't answer the question, but you answer it for him, Stephen. You say, so let me answer the question Mike Pence couldn't answer. Am I wrong here? Because then it highlights the lie without calling him a liar. Am I wrong or right?
I think you're right, but here's what is so frustrating, and I've read a couple of good columns on this in the past couple of weeks. The Republican position on healthcare is so bad that voters literally don't believe it. They literally don't believe that Donald Trump and Republicans hold a position of taking health insurance away from millions of people, of taking it, of making it so that if you have any kind of pre-existing condition, you might pay 10, 20, 100 times as much and be completely priced out of the market. They sit there and they lie and they lie and they lie and they say, well, protect your pre-existing conditions, which makes people think that, oh, well, I had asthma, I can still get my health insurance. And yeah, it's protected, you can still buy health insurance. It's just they might charge you 10 times as much, which again is not what any of us are actually thinking. So, you know, Democrats, I don't know how much it's, they need to do a better job. They need to do a better job making the case. They need to be more vehement, more fervent, more honest, calling the Republicans out on the lies constantly. But it's kind of amazing that Republicans' actual position is so shameful, right? Yes. That people literally, like you would think people would say, well, Republicans are for kicking puppies. And people are going to say, oh, well, no, you're just making that up. That's Democratic spin. But, you know, this is the equivalent. This is the equivalent of kicking puppies, of saying, you know what, you had cancer, you don't get to buy health insurance. And that really is what they're for. And, you know, so just in terms of shaping the practical politics of this, it makes it really hard. And I do want to say, in Joe Biden's defense and all, getting to 50 Senate votes for what's going to be on health care is really tough. And I love Medicare for all. I think it's great. But I think it's also not unreasonable to say, you know what, maybe something more like a robust public
option.
We can't fix to fix Obamacare is something I can actually do.
I was interviewed by, was it Fox or some conservative group, and I did point out, Ron Abramson, that if you look at Joe Biden's agenda, because he says he is the Democratic Party, and he's absolutely right. You know, don't tell me what AOC is saying. Don't tell me what Bernie is saying. Don't tell me what Elizabeth Warren is saying. They are not the head of the party. I am. It is my policies. But if you actually read his policies, they are the most progressive set of policies, Ron, that have ever existed in Democratic history. Now, that sounds like, oh, Arnie, but it's absolutely true. When you look at things like climate change, and you look at things like healthcare, and you look at increasing the wages, and you look at what's happening with college, and you're looking at what's happening with daycare, holy crap. If he does even half of that, it will be a shock to the system in a positive way, Ron.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's so many metaphors. You know, when I got on board and sort of really came to terms with being a true progressive in 2015, 2016, and worked with Bernie Sanders, you know, my feeling became, if we're only ever going to get half a loaf, let's go for a goddamn bigger loaf.
Yes.
Let's aim higher. And, you know, that brings you back around again to the political scientists, to the Overton window, you know, in the sense that we are, you know, Medicare for All seemed like a fringe, extremist, fanciful proposition. Absolutely. When Bernie first started talking about it, you know, nationally, what, maybe 6-8 years ago, and then it became part of his campaign platform in 2016. And now it is, it may not be adequately popular, but it is a legitimate possibility to discuss. And I think Kamala Harris missed a great opportunity at the debate to talk about the Green New Deal. The moderator even gave her the language by saying framework. That's all she had to say is, you know, we don't believe that the Green New Deal is something we can necessarily enact overnight in the first 100 days of this administration, but the principles espoused in the Green New Deal are critical, not just to our economic vitality, but to the survival of our planet.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Vice President Pence, take it away.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. So Dean, the thing that Donald Trump wants to run on between now and the next, and the election, in the next couple of days, he wants to run on safety and security and the police. He is going to bring back stability. So what I just told happened at UNC Asheville, he loves that. That's phenomenal. What just happened in Michigan, he loves that. What's happening in Oregon, he loves that, because he wants to bring safety and security, and he's going to be talking to those suburban women, at least that's what he says. And one of the things that really gets me angry, Dean, is that Joe Biden hasn't looked at Donald Trump and hasn't looked at the populace and said, do you know who's defunding the police? Donald Trump. He is defunding the police, because who pays the police? Your city and town and your state. Who is hemorrhaging money? Who is firing all this municipal personnel? It is cities and towns, not because they don't want safety, they don't want security, they don't want cops, they don't want firefighters, but they can't do it with air. And Donald Trump, by not helping with that second stimulus, he is actually defunding the police. Why can't they use his language against him, Dean?
Yeah, it's a fair question. The argument you're making, I have heard, but I've mainly heard it from Democratic governors and some Democratic members of Congress who take that step and say, okay, the Republicans in Congress seem intent on blocking money going to cities and local governments. But the reality of that is it affects first responders, police, fire, EMT, et cetera. So it's certainly an argument he could make more forcefully. I thought on the whole law and order suburban women, as Trump called the argument a while back, I thought Biden did a pretty good job of recasting the suburbs in his one debate with Trump, where he literally said Trump's notion of the suburbs is like out of the 1950s, suburbs are multicultural now, multiracial. This whole idea of Trump's about using fear to scare people in suburban communities, I don't know how much traction he's getting with that.
So Stephen, we only have a few minutes left. I really want Joe Biden to talk about the defunding of the police, because I hear what Dean is saying, that the governors are saying it and whatever, but this goes back to the stimulus, which is why he can use it. So he can use Donald Trump's perceived weapon about the defunding the police and then turn it on its head, because then you can point to what you are not doing by offering us another stimulus is you are defunding the police, creating more chaos in the street, more unemployed, longer food lines, and that only is going to precipitate more instability. He should own it and not leave it to the governors, Stephen.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think to some degree, Joe Biden feels a bit of a tightrope with this issue, because he does, you know, in terms of he doesn't want to be say anything that can be seen as against police reform, which is obviously desperately needed, and turn off his base. And obviously one can do all of these things, as you've discussed. But, you know, again, honestly, strategically, big picture, Joe Biden needs to be talking about COVID. You know, this is a COVID election. We are in a pandemic that our president has handled disastrously poorly. The vast majority of the public, even a non-trivial amount of Donald Trump supporters, understand this. And, you know, to a degree, it's like, right, so 1992, Bill Clinton was famously, it's the economy, stupid. If you're Joe Biden, it's the COVID, stupid.
No, you're absolutely right. And last but not least, Ron, of course, Donald Trump says it's going to magically disappear and that the fact that he has survived COVID is a miracle. Now, I'm thinking magic and miracles. That is his response to COVID. And I think in a lot of ways, what Stephen has said is absolutely right. This is the pandemic year, and magic and miracles, I don't know if that cuts it, Ron.
And the polls are bearing that out. There's been a bit of a free fall in terms of the numbers since between the debate and the COVID announcements. And they are dodging the key that, you know, whatever bad number you want to put on it. I was going to say the 64,000 or the $210,000 question, which is, when was the president's last COVID test?
Yes.
And the fact that they won't answer that suggests he wasn't getting tested and that he just didn't think that this applied to him. And there are credible theories that he is patient zero for the administration's infection outbreak. And, you know, it's a pretty simple political pitch. Again, I'm not a political strategist, but if Donald Trump can't keep himself and his inner circle safe from COVID, how is he going to keep you safe from it?
And on that note, what a perfect way to end. Let me thank my fabulous guests, Professor Stephen Green, Professor Dean Spilionis, and Attorney Ron Abramson for joining us on Rethink the Week. This is Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We will schmooze tomorrow. Thank you, gentlemen.
Listen up, get ready, I'm not gonna take no more. There's a revolution, a revelation going on in my soul. Buckle up, get ready, we're not gonna sit back and wait and allow ourselves and each other to lose control of our fate. There'll be no sacrifice, no more tears.